Hello, I'm Richard Adie. This is The Money. If you have a Year 12 student at your house, you'll know they're either in study lockdown already or they're just about to be. We're approaching the exams that will have a critical impact on determining their options over the next few years. It's exciting. It's a beautiful new day. Hey. So today on the show, universities, are they worth it? Andreas Schleicher has no doubt. He's Director of Education and Skills at the OECD.
Today, everybody needs to have something beyond school. That can be university, but that can also be an advanced vocational qualification. So I think in this broader spectrum, countries that get that balance right, that can provide a broad range of different kind of qualifications and skills, are better placed. And you find some of them in Europe. You can find Canada in North America. But I also position Australia quite well. You do have a majority of young people who are now going beyond sort of the schooling towards a good tertiary qualification.
This is an economics show. How important are universities to the economy? Andrew Norton directs the higher education program at the Grattan Institute.
Well, they're still a relatively small share of the economy in terms of their annual economic activity, maybe 2%. But if you think about the way they train workers for a huge range of vital professions, if you think about their contribution to exports, if you think about their contribution to migration in terms of international students who stay in Australia after completing their studies, they really have a much broader impact on both the Australian economy and the Australian society more generally.
Do we have an idea of what we spend on them?
Well, probably we spend low 30 billions in terms of public and private expenditure. About 60% of that is at least nominally public at the moment, but the public-private shares vary a lot over time. And depending on how you calculate it, for the students themselves, domestic students, they pay about 40% of the cost of their education. But obviously internationals pay all the cost of their education and then a large profit margin on top of that.
They have become pretty much vital to our universities, haven't they, international students?
They have, and they're really the main source of what we call discretionary revenue, that is money they can essentially spend on whatever they think is most important. And that's why I think they're valued, you know, over and above the sheer number of billions of dollars they bring in.
International students contribute about a fifth of Australian universities' income. But what's in it for them? Well, the same two things that are in it for anyone who goes. Alison Wolfe, Professor the Baroness Wolfe of Dulwich, if we're being formal, is at King's College London. She's been researching higher education for decades.
Universities label you, they stick their brand on you, and they also teach you things. And those of us who work in universities do work really quite hard to teach people things, I should say. But for today's students, even more than in the past, a large part of what they are coming to university for and a large part of their willingness to pay fees to do so comes from the fact that it signals to society, by sticking this brand label on them, that they are relatively intelligent, pretty good future employees, the sort of people you would like in your company, and the sort of people that you won't get sacked for hiring.
Hiring is a huge part of this, and increasingly, you don't get hired without a degree.
Yeah, this is called credentialism. That's, you know, employers either requiring or preferring someone with a degree for a job that maybe, strictly speaking, doesn't need a degree. What that means is that in order to be eligible for those jobs, in order for your application not to be thrown in the bin, you actually have to have a bachelor degree on your CV. And of course, that creates problems for people who could do the job but don't have that bachelor degree.
There's degrees and degrees. There's also universities and universities. Australia has 43. Britain, well over 100.
You start to get this very, very marked hierarchy of which students are tremendously aware. So they want to go to name brand universities. And name brand universities increasingly are the ones that appear in one of the international tables of the world's best universities. So there's tremendous pressure on them. I don't want to overstate this, because if you are very clear about what you want to do in life, and some people are, though most students aren't, there will still be very specialist institutions which may not be recognised names around the world, but which you know you want to go to if you want to go into design, if you want to go into agriculture, if you want to do very specific things. So it's possible to have specialist niche institutions which are not huge research universities that appear in the tables. But basically, if I ask students, why did you come to King's, once they've sort of got embarrassed about answering, they will say, well, it's one of the top names.
Britain has quite a number of top names, institutions that are highly ranked on the international league tables. As well as Oxford and Cambridge, there's Imperial College, UCL, King's, the London School of Economics, the list goes on. Australia has some wonderful universities, but Melbourne, the ANU, Sydney and UQ are not big brands in the same way. Which probably explains why where you go here doesn't matter as much as it does in the UK.
Probably we think there's something like a 6-10% earning advantage to attending a group of eight research kind of sandstone university. Whereas in the UK, the differences between, you know, an ordinary university and an Oxford or Cambridge really seem to be very, very significant. So in the UK, where you go seems to matter a huge amount. In Australia, it only matters a moderate amount.
So what does matter? Is it what you do that matters?
Yeah, our research very consistently finds that if you do a degree which has relatively good earnings, such as the medicine, dentistry, law, engineering degrees like that, that is really the key to good earnings. You'd be better off doing your engineering at a low-prestige university than arts at a high-prestige university in Australia.
What about the other part of the university's economic value, their contribution to the knowledge economy?
Look, it's very hard to quantify, but there's two big elements here. I think the most important one is providing the kinds of skills that enable people to work in advanced knowledge economy occupations. And the lesser one, even though it probably gets more policy attention, is the role of universities in economic innovation. A lot of policy emphasis on that, but the reality is that, generally speaking, Australia is a fairly small section of the global economy. The main thing for us is going to be adopting innovation from around the world rather than new ideas that are completely unique to Australia.
On The Money today, universities. They're bigger and there's more of them than there's ever been before. On those measures, they seem to be thriving. But Ross Gittins, economics editor at the Sydney Morning Herald, says there's something wrong.
I think that they've suffered greatly from the fact that for about the past 30 years, federal governments of both colours have been basically trying to edge them off the federal government's budget. I call it a process of backdoor privatisation. You think of other sources of revenue that the universities could pursue, overseas students, HECS, and then you just cut back the federal government grant to fit. And you keep cutting it back until you finally got them off the books completely.
Over that three-decade time span, the trend is clear, but it isn't always all one way.
The one big qualification to that is the change that Julia Gillard introduced in 2012, which was called demand-driven undergraduate university places. That's where, until that point, the federal government had said to each individual university, you're allowed to give university places to this many people broken up into these different courses. And when the government was holding back the demand, the universities were rationing places by having very high cutoff levels for whatever was the latest version of the university admission rank. When the government said, well, you decide how many people you're going to let in, the universities went crazy. There was a huge increase. You can look at a graph, it just shoots up after this change. Some universities much more than others. I think this is much truer of regional universities and kind of lesser city universities than it is of the big name universities, what sometimes people call the sandstone universities.
One of the effects of 30-odd years of reforms, both here and in Britain, has been to make vice-chancellors focus on money.
I think it's absolutely about that. I think that there are vice-chancellors who think seriously about strategy and the type of institution that they want to be. But a lot of it is about short-term, how do we stay, or how do we go up the table? But mostly it's about balancing the books, running huge budgets. Sometimes I feel as if real estate drives the institution, that what people really have to focus on more than anything else, at least among English universities, is expanding the real estate, paying for the real estate, making sure that there are rooms for undergraduates to sleep in when they first arrive. That's part of the student experience, quote unquote. It's not very academic.
Part of that comes from the massive increase in the numbers of young people going to university. In Britain, former Prime Minister Tony Blair set a target of 50%, and the Brits are now at about 40%. Here, it's a bit harder to say, but it's certainly above 30%, and it's increased more than threefold since the 80s.
I can remember talking to a famous economist who'd just written a first-year textbook, which had about 30 chapters. And I said to him, I don't understand why you've got so many chapters. He said, it's a chapter per lecture. I said, my lecturers, when I was at university, would have been far too proud than to teach out of a single textbook and say, right, before you come to the lecture, make sure you've read chapter 23. He said, well, that's fine, Ross, but now we've got a much higher proportion of the cohort going to university. So in other words, the average student isn't nearly as bright, as elite as they used to be. And so we've had to adjust to fit. Now, I think that's true. I think that's in a sense inevitable. If you're going from 10% of young people going to uni to 40%, then the average ability of the 40% has to be lower than the average ability of the top 10. That's inevitable, but if you push that too far, then you're really starting to downgrade the value of the degree that you're giving people.
That is a real concern.
The quality of the undergraduate education that we're giving to our young people is declining for two reasons. One reason is because we're just letting in people who probably should be going to TAFE, would be better off going to TAFE. We would be more likely to finish the course if they went to TAFE, and more likely to find a job if they went to TAFE. That's one part of it. The other part of it is that there's a lot of pressure on using undergraduates to get the money in, even though the university, if it had its druthers, would really like to just focus on the research. Now, I'm not saying that means that no lecturer cares about the quality of the education that they give to undergraduates, but that quality has declined, and I find plenty of students complaining to me that they don't get proper lecturers. They get stand-ins. They get casuals, part-timers who are used to replace the lecturers, who have managed to win themselves a government grant to do some research. And in a sense, this is their reward. They're given money to buy out their obligation to teach students.
So what about Ross's point? Given the huge growth in enrolments, should everyone who's at university actually be there? Andrew Norton.
I think the answer to that is probably no. It's very hard to say exactly what the number should be, but if you think about the people who are not finishing and then the people who don't get jobs that actually require the skills they've acquired, you've got to think about, could they have achieved the kind of job they do have in less time and lower cost by doing some other course? I think there are big differences between men and women for this, that if we look at the financial benefits of doing vocational education for women, they're actually very small to non-existent compared to year 12 only. So they might get a different job with their vocational qualification, but they won't get a high-paying job compared to year 12. But for men, there are still good diploma, certificate 3 and 4 jobs, which will provide reasonable salaries and good employment rates. And I think particularly for the young men who are currently being drawn into higher education who didn't do that well at school, probably their better option might be one of the upper-level vocational qualifications.
You can be whatever you want to be. Be a game designer. Be a winemaker. Be an educator. Be a makeup artist. Be hands-on, be industry-trained, be in demand. Be smart with your money through affordable programs at TAFE.
This is The Money on RN, the ABC Listen app, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Addy. Today we're talking about universities, and we can't talk about them without talking about vocational education and training, or VET. We could do a whole program on this sector, and we will, but for now you need to know that this used to more or less mean TAFE. A series of reforms to funding opened it up to private sector providers, some of whom turned out to be shonks, some of whom went bust. There was rorting, there was incompetence, and there were billions in loans to students that may never be repaid. Because of that, it's harder for VET students to fund their educations. Ross Gittins.
The government has got to accept that most of their vocational education will be done by TAFE, which is owned by the government, and they've got to reform that TAFE to make sure it keeps up with the changing needs of employers. Bearing in mind that really you're supposed to be doing this for the students, but to help the students, you've got to make sure you're giving them skills that some employer wants to pay for. So that says, get real, it's still going to come mainly from the government, and so fix up the government and don't try and use cheap economist shortcuts like saying, we'll make it contestable and it will fix itself.
Andrew Norton from the Grattan Institute.
Well, I think it was a piece of very bad historical luck that there were some bad policy decisions in vocational education at just the time it really needed to compete with the university sector. And I think we are going down the track of repairing what's happened in vocational education, but there are still real problems. For example, the reforms to the student loan scheme in vocational education, though desperately needed given what was going on, mean that for some diploma courses, you have to pay some of the cost of education up front, whereas in higher education, you can defer through HELP or HECS all the cost of your education. And so there might be some people who are choosing a bachelor degree, even though that's not the most appropriate qualification, because it is the one that enables them to study without paying any upfront fees. That's obviously a problem.
What are the consequences when you neglect or run down your technical education and create a lot of universities? Alison Wolfe.
I think there are two consequences. The first is that a large number of people go and do degrees in universities, which are not adding anything very much to the skill mix of the country, and adding less and less as more and more people go to their own prospects. So I think that essentially you're kind of robbing these kids because they give up time, they spend a long time in courses which they often don't particularly enjoy. You get high dropout rates, and they are, in both our countries, piling up debts, which, okay, so maybe they don't have to pay them and eat bread and water. I mean, maybe they're income contingent, but these are real debts, and they affect their decision-making, they affect their credit rating, they affect all sorts of things. So I actually think it's wrong. And then the other thing that you get is you actually get holes in your, I don't really like the term, but your human capital infrastructure, if you like. You're not actually creating and maintaining high quality technical education facilities. And that actually has a knock-on effect on apprenticeships as well as on people who are doing full-time technical type education. Because if you don't have a sizable, high-profile technical education sector, it always goes to the bottom of the heap when there's a fight over budgets, it doesn't get maintained, and so you get into a vicious rather than a virtuous circle.
On The Money today, we're looking at universities. They've changed a lot in the last few decades, but Andreas Schleicher from the OECD says they have to change more.
Universities were designed for a very different time, you know, to educate a very small academic elite. And today they cater for the majority of young people. So the range of services, the range of needs has broadened. And universities have often, you know, a hard time adapt to this. The future of learning is about, you know, you as an individual figuring out what you learn, how you learn, when you learn, where you learn. I think learning will become a lot more modular. and be much better spread over the life cycle. And universities have a hard time getting to grips with this. Our kind of qualifications and degrees are still very lumpy. You know, if you continue learning at the workplace or learning in later in life in university, I think there's still a big gap between, you know, the needs of the modern society and the traditional universities as institutions.
And that isn't the only gap that Andreas is concerned about.
There is a big gap between the requirements of modern workplaces and the skills that people graduate with. Now, we are still sort of, when you look at actually what it takes to be successful, this is not only, you know, being good in physics or history, it's about, you know, being able to think creatively, work imaginatively, work collaboratively. Those kinds of social emotional skills are often very well developed in the vocational sector, and people who just, you know, go for one side of institutions may not get that full range of learning opportunities.
Andrew Norton says Australian universities are working to address this issue.
A lot has been happening over the last 25 years, that there's been slow but steady improvement in teaching. Now that we know that employment is an issue, universities are doing all sorts of things to try and improve the employability of their graduates. So we're seeing a big expansion in what we call work integrated learning, which is doing part of your education while in a workplace. That's probably one of the most successful things that universities have done. I think it's both instructive in itself, and it enables the students to understand what the employers want, and it gives the employers a look at the students. And you see that a lot of employers end up hiring people who've done some study with them.
But the man from the OECD says the advent of digital technology will move the universities further.
Universities take their strengths currently from offering you a combination of education content. They deliver that, and they provide the accreditation. That's what creates very powerful monopolies for universities. But in the digital world, you know, content as an individual you can access in any form, anywhere. Now, that's what the digital world offers. Delivery, you know, you don't need to go to your university professor right next door. You can listen to the best, you know, teachers anywhere in the world. Delivery is becoming more fluid. And accreditation, that's still the holy grail, but I do see that there are sort of systems of micro-credentialing coming up, employers looking at different ways of, you know, accrediting learning. So universities may lose their kind of traditional power of bundling those three things, and this unbundling will create a very different world of higher education. There will be multiple providers. Some will actually focus on content, making content universally available. Others will see their strengths in the delivery of educational services and teaching. So I think universities need to sort of look at this much more creatively, where they want to position themselves in the digital world.
That's the future. What about now? Is university worth it?
Well, you can look at this for an individual. Actually, if you are studying, you get a university degree in Australia, you get about $300,000 in earnings more than those who do not study. And for taxpayers, it works in a similar way. You have a tax return in Australia of more than $100,000 per graduate. So actually, that means better educated people pay more taxes, incur lower social costs. So actually, it's a good investment.
Alison Wolfe, what do you think?
It's worth it for the student, usually, because life is a relative business. It's about clawing your way up past other people in the job market. So if a degree puts you ahead of other people, for most people, that's a reasonable bargain. And the point comes at which it isn't, but it's kind of hard for people to know when that moment comes, and whether or not they decide a university degree isn't for them will depend in part on what else is offered by other parts of the education system. Is it worth it for the institution? Being a top research university is definitely worth it. It means that you can do a lot of things that you couldn't do otherwise, which are quite close to what your academics think of as an academic mission. So it does enable you to have good libraries, good research facilities, underwrite research which is not fully paid for from outside. There are a whole load of attractions to being one of these big elite institutions like the one I'm lucky enough to work in. But it does also bring enormous strains. And I think that one of the things that we're increasingly aware of in this country is that the top institutions somehow get detached from local society. They're no longer as civic as they once were. And they also, of course, become quite bureaucratic and quite driven by terrifying budget numbers and real estate decisions, and it can feel quite a long way from a community of scholars.
And that's not all. As you move up in scale, she says, the case for universities becomes less convincing.
For the country, I'm decreasingly convinced that this makes sense. It creates a sheeps and goats situation in the labour market between those who do get a degree and those who don't. It's an enormous, I don't want to say a waste of resource, but it's an enormous commitment of resource here, both by individuals and by the taxpayer who's underwriting a huge amount of this, paying for it directly or backing the loans. The expenditure is vast. And I said earlier that one of the things that universities do is they teach skills, and indeed they do. But the implicit promise behind all of this is not only will you be richer than the next person, but you will actually be richer. In other words, it's not just that you'll be further up the ladder, but the whole ladder will have moved up, you know, sort of rising tides and all the rest of it. It's decreasingly likely that that's a guaranteed outcome. I mean, in this country, we have still got a situation where you earn more if you're a graduate. But actually, the wages of the young, while the number of graduates has gone on increasing, actual wages have not been increasing. So you do start to feel that for the country, you're coming out with a divided population where those who don't go to university feel under increasing pressure to do so. And in terms of actual economic growth, it's not very obvious.
That's the UK. Here in Australia, Andrew Norton's convinced of their importance.
I think they are more important now than they've ever been before in Australia's history. That partly reflects the nature of the labour market, that even though some graduates are struggling to find work, the number of jobs that actually require degrees goes up almost every year. And so universities have got a vital role in the labour market in a way they simply didn't beyond a few professions 40 or 50 years ago.
Thanks to Andrew Norton, who directs the Higher Education Program at the Grattan Institute, Professor Alison Wolfe of King's College London, Andreas Schleicher, Director for Education and Skills at the OECD, and Ross Gittins, the Economics Editor at the Sydney Morning Herald. You'll find more details, including links to articles by Ross and Alison, on our homepage at abc.net.au/rn. The Money is produced by Kate Piercy. Our sound engineer is Isabella Tropiano. I'm Richard Ady. Everybody's got to do.